Hi, I'm Yusuf Zine. My latest TVO Today podcast is on how a Canadian ends up in a Chinese prison and if he's even alive. Listen and subscribe to Extradition. Available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Help TVO create a better world through the power of learning. Visit TVO.org and make a tax-deductible donation today.
Views about social media vary widely, from a cesspool that brings out the worst in people to indispensable sites of modern communication. The federal government recently introduced legislation aimed, it says, at making the online universe much less of a toxic brew. Bill C-63, the Online Harms Act, would tackle abuse with serious consequences for hate crimes, including possible prison time. With us now on what's needed to make Canadians safer in the digital world, we are joined by Sabrina Dellen. She is Chief Executive Officer of the Samara Center for Democracy. Barbara Perry, Director at the Center on Hate, Bias and Extremism at Ontario Tech University. And Dax D'Arazio, who is a postdoctoral fellow in the Department of Political Studies at Queen's University. And it's great to have you two on the ends back here and you here for the first time. Thanks for joining us. Let's just set the table here. What's this bill, Sabrina, trying to do?
So the purpose of this bill is to protect children from hateful content that's online. And what that entails is policing 7 different forms of content or hate speech, and also establishing a digital safety commission that's going to be tasked with regulating large platforms. So this matters because online violence is violence. For young people, this can entail self-harm or even suicide. And this is about responding to platforms that amplify and circulate content in a way that normalizes hate, puts our youth at risk, and threatens our democracy. So what we have here is something that's informed by other countries that are further along in how they've developed protections for their citizens, and also something that's been shaped by the insights of civil society researchers who have been working to hold these platforms to account.
In your view, is it genuinely only aimed at young people?
I think there is a spillover effect to the general population at large. If we're looking at protections for kids, it's also going to affect the grown-ups in their lives as well. We know, especially during the course of the pandemic, kids are increasingly online, and the grown-ups in their world have been kind of outmaneuvered in terms of how they're handling technology. There's a broader concern around digital media literacy that is of national relevance. So this is something that does affect all of us.
Dax, how about in your view? Is this genuinely aimed exclusively at preventing harm to children?
Not exclusively, no. I think there are actually 2 elements of the bill here. So one is what I would describe as really non-controversial, which is improving the transparency and accountability of digital platforms. And that essentially brings Canada in line with comparator countries who have created similar online harms legislation to create some sort of regulatory framework. And digital media companies, digital platforms actually want to work with governments to figure out where those reasonable limits for expression would be online. There's almost universal consensus that the status quo is untenable for Canadian digital regulations in this specific sphere. So that's non-controversial. The potentially controversial bits of the bill are the amendments to hate speech prohibitions. So the amendments to the Criminal Code specifically, and also the amendments to the Canadian Human Rights Act.
Can I ask you about that? Is there truly a consensus that the status quo is untenable and something has to be done?
I don't think there is a consensus. I think that there is a divide. There's incredible polarization around what constitutes hate speech, around the need to regulate it, the sense that it's free expression. I draw a fine line between hate speech and free speech, and I think about it as dangerous speech, and this is what it's intended to address, is speech that, and this is a nice thing, where there's a definition now of hate. So it's speech that vilifies or represents detestation associated with the community. So I think very important there from some perspectives, but not all.
Can I just jump in on that?
Yeah.
You really think it's a fine line?
I think it's actually an increasingly blurred line, I think. What has refined it are, and this is where the definition comes from that they've included, what has refined it is successive court decisions which have tried to define hate. And we've had a Canadian Human Rights Tribunal case that has also distilled those into 11 hallmarks of hate, which are informing that definition. So this is an attempt, I think, to make that a finer line, if you will, to draw that distinction more clearly.
Can we talk about that line for a second, about how either fine or squishy or hazy, or what was the word you used?
Blurry.
Blurry. Whether it's blurry about the difference between legitimate, offensive, but legal speech and what's truly hateful and illegal.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I want to talk about the Canadian Race Relations Foundation's poll from 2021 that found that 79% of Canadians want to see hateful speech online and racism addressed with the same level of seriousness as in-person hate crimes. Mm. And at the Samara Center, we've been monitoring, studying, and quantifying the ugliness of political conversations online. And so we know that they have a chilling effect on the public. It pushes people away instead of drawing them in. That's a freedom of speech and expression issue as well. I think another element to bring into this is not just the freedom of speech, but also freedom of reach, which is getting at the extent that these platforms are able to share content that's likely out of proportion to its prevalence in the real world.
Let me come at it from another side, Barbara, which is even if you manage to find some kind of consensus, which you two may disagree on whether or not it exists, do you have confidence that the big social media companies, Meta, for example, would actually play ball here and enforce the rules that a passed bill would tell them they have to enforce?
Well, I think we've seen resistance in other countries. So that is going to be, I think, part of the battle here in the role of the commissions that are struck is to engage with those companies to consider how to bring them to the table more fully. I mean, they have been at the table, right? They've been part of this conversation. They've expressed the resistance, but I think they've also expressed to some extent how far they are willing to go. So I think there's still a lot of negotiation that needs to be done there. And I think you suggested, you know, that they're willing to have that conversation.
Dax?
I think the basic problem here when it comes to regulating hate speech or having hate prohibitions is that we have the criminal code, which is in some sense insufficient. It essentially plays whack-a-mole with the most concerning extremists in Canada. The threshold of harm, which is hate, is really high in the criminal code. It requires the consent of an attorney general, for example, to lay criminal charges. And arguably, police, when they are investigating hate, have a bit of a, they go light. You only see the most concerning extreme forms of hate being prosecuted in Canada. Statutory human rights protections have a role to play in mitigating discrimination, but the threshold or the bar is slightly lower for the Canadian Human Rights Act. And the commission and the tribunal, there's something positive in the sense that it increases access to justice. Somebody doesn't have to go to the police to file a complaint and rely upon the discretion of the police and the Crown to lay criminal charges. The problem is that the most concerning hate speech is not just on the, is not just an outlier at the far edges of public discourse in Canada. We see it trickle into the mainstream. And we have, just because something isn't illegal doesn't mean that it's not harmful to society and corrode our public discourse and push people that are targets of hate speech outside of public discourse so they feel like they can't contribute. So navigating that fine line is really difficult. And I'm expecting to see a lot of pushback and a lot of controversy in reanimating specifically Section 13 of the Canadian Human Rights Act, which was repealed almost a decade ago. Mm-hmm. And there was a quite animated public debate about the merits of that legislation. And in that debate, several legitimate questions about freedom of expression were raised.
And let me follow up on that with you, Sabrina, because I think we understand as we watch this debate unfold that we're trying to figure out a balancing act here, right? Mm-hmm. On the one hand, we want to have robust free speech in a Western-style parliamentary democratic system. On the other hand, you know, we do have to watch out that hate speech doesn't turn into murderous behavior and lead to really awful things. This bill's trying to find a balance. Mm-hmm. How well is it doing at finding that balance?
I mean, this is very complex and nuanced territory. One single piece of legislation, even something as complex as this, is not going to solve this problem outright. Two pieces that I think are of significance for the public interest is the creation of this regulator. There's been some concern about the wide-ranging powers. What will it look like in terms of a user experience to have somewhere to go with these complaints? Because as Dax has noted, right now people just have the police to go to, and it doesn't feel sufficient, or it doesn't feel like it's really quite satisfying or resolving the problem in a useful way. There's also the possibility of creating an ombudsperson, which would be an advocate for the victims. And so what we have here is an evolution culturally and socially in terms of how we frame this problem, giving the public a destination, processes, ways to even just have language to describe that this is truly a problem. There's still a sense that what happens online isn't really real, isn't really that bad. What are you supposed to do? So there's a legitimizing aspect to this that's of use for victims, but it's also something that we should expect and hope to evolve, especially as our understanding of technology's influence on our communities and our democracy increases.
Let me pick up on the angle of the regulator, because we have seen in the past where the current federal government appoints people to make decisions about how they're going to dispense money, for example, and conservatives understandably think you've skewed the deck here and you're only giving to your friends, etc. You've interpreted things to coincide with your particular ideology. And if in the future the conservatives form the government, I'm sure liberals will say, you know, you've appointed a regulator who only sees things your way and isn't giving our side fair shake here. What do we do about that?
Well, the partisanship is problematic in this space in particular. We know the harms that online hate is doing. We see it in terms of the direct harm of the speech itself on youth and adults as well, who are members of marginalized and detested and vilified communities. But I think we also see the harm in terms of the relationship between online action and offline action in the mass murders that we've seen associated with the far-right activism, for example. All of the mass homicides that we've had in the past 7 years or so have been motivated by people or committed by people who have been engaging online and have been radicalized online. So there's two sides in terms of the harm to the victims, but also the risk that it poses in terms of mobilizing and normalizing, as I think you've referred to, normalizing those narratives in a way that carries into our offline interactions with people. So I think that we need to put that partisanship aside to acknowledge those harms.
What government is going to put partisanship aside in choosing a regulator?
Gone are the days. You know. Yeah. But this is, and we've seen, I mean, we have seen people across party lines, not leaders necessarily, but we have seen MPs themselves come forward and, you know, support it across the floor. So I think that we need to see more of that cooperation. Not going to happen, I think, around the regulator piece, because I think there's suspicion, obviously, when we're talking about removing big government and replacing it with smaller government. I think that that is going to be really one of the pressure points in these debates.
Okay, let's come back to where we started here, which was talking about a bill designed to protect younger people from the abuse that they suffer online. And I want to share some stats here. Sheldon, we're on page 2 in the middle. Let's bring this graphic up here. These are some stats from Statistics Canada about the impact that online hate has on younger people. And here we go. More than 7 in 10 young people have been exposed to online hate and violence. 7 in 10. Nearly 1/4 of victims of cyber-related hate crimes are young people aged 12 to 17. A quarter. Teenage boys aged 12 to 17 are 6 times more likely than teenage girls to be charged with or accused of a cyber-related hate crime. And as anybody who spends any time online will know, young women are most often the victims of online harassment. What is it, okay, Barbara, I'm coming back to you. What is it about the cyber landscape that seems to make young people disproportionate purveyors and victims of this stuff?
I think there are so many factors that come into play here. There is the breadth of the conversations and narratives, so you feel like you're not the only one who has that feeling, that that attitude, that perception, so it feels safe. It feels safe just to be behind the computer, that you can, in spite of the fact that you're not anonymous, there's a feeling of anonymity in that space. So again, that's another thing that makes you feel safe and free to express yourself as you would. And I think that there's also the affected voices and the sympathetic voices are often silenced, and so the louder voices are probably the most harmful and the most damaging.
And the most amplified.
Yeah, absolutely. And so again, it permits others to express themselves in a similar way, sometimes even if they don't believe it, but as a way of being part of the crowd. Mm. So I think there are so many factors there that we have to consider in terms of why people feel so free to engage in that way online, which they wouldn't do face-to-face, most people.
They never do. They're not that gutsy. I shouldn't say never. Most often not. Dax, you're on a post-secondary campus as well. You see the impact this has on younger people in your daily activities?
Absolutely, I do.
What does it look like?
Well, there's also an algorithmic component, which is previously, if you wanted information, you could go to the library, pick out a book off of a shelf. Now you can get into a pipeline of extremism quite easily, where even innocently stumbling upon some content online, the algorithm will very sneakily just keep pitching you sometimes what appears to be edgy content that might be entertaining. And that's how perceptions are shifted. As far as just digital media use in general, I think we're now catching up to reality and having what I think is a nuanced conversation about navigating a really healthy relationship with technology. And this is really important for youth these days. You know, walking around the Queen's campus, for example, I'll sometimes see people walk into a lamppost staring at their phone, and that might be funny at the moment, but when I look at the relationship that students are navigating with technology, it's a brave new world compared to what I experienced. I remember dial-up internet and the exhilaration of the internet just blossoming, and now it looks like a toxic hellscape in some instances. And I really feel for youth who are navigating that, because the expressive landscape is just so different. There's been a death of nuance. There's been a death of charity. And on university campuses, we're trying to instill something that you might call intellectual humility or civic virtue, how to express themselves across difference and be sensitive to other people, other identities, other experiences. Online, it's very difficult to be intellectually curious. And so universities have a huge role to play in instilling some of those values in society.
Quick follow-up with you. Do you find that young people are so into their phones now and are perhaps inappropriately communicating in a very aggressive, violent way on their phones with each other, they have actually lost the art of civilized conversation? You see that?
I don't want to channel my inner boomer here and just say those darn kids these days. I see some very unhealthy engagements with the online digital environment, for sure. Also, when you look at the rates of experiencing mental health, especially among younger cohorts or the younger generation, I think there's an intimate link between online environments and struggling with mental health concerns as well. I think what needs to happen, and perhaps parts of this bill are one way of at least starting a conversation or creating a regulatory framework for this, is that when people are using digital media platforms, they're actually aware of some of the risks that are latent and for some users obvious. People should be cognizant of some of the risks and also the benefits of using technology. And we're really catching up to that conversation, I think.
Go ahead.
I'd like to add, you know, there are obviously harms online and youth definitely need to be protected. Youth often get criticized for being apathetic and not civically engaged, and they are not interested in joining a political party. Maybe they're not going to come out and vote. But they do use technology towards civic ends in a way that is of use to our society and is of benefit to their mental health and well-being.
Give us an example of this.
Actually, during the pandemic, it was youth that were mobilizing and sharing information about how to keep their communities healthy and safe. It was youth that were talking about mobilizing around global movements, Black Lives Matter, climate change. They are very much engaged and able to use digital spaces in a healthy way. They can model better behaviors for the grown-ups in their lives as well. It's not just doom and gloom and horrendous. Certainly there's an aspect of that that needs to be addressed. But this type of legislation has the capacity to address those horrible things, but also restore some of the pro-democracy aspects of these platforms and provide conditions for healthy and productive civic conversations. And we can take some cues from young people here.
Your organization focuses on democracy and democratic engagement and how we can contribute to a better sense around all of that. And I guess part of that mission is sort of promoting the circumstances that would allow for people to feel good about putting their name on a ballot and standing for office, which not a lot of people feel good about today. So my question is, what kind of impact do you think all of this hate speech, toxicity, call it what you want, is having on the, I resist using this word, but I'm sorry, the quality of people who are prepared to stand for office today?
Yeah, one concern is that, you know, if this is what it's like, we're going to attract people who can just keep their elbows out in these types of conditions and aren't going to be able to solve other kinds of complex problems that we need a hand with right now. At the Samara Center, we have a study where we've tracked abusive content received by candidates in Canadian elections on X, formerly Twitter. We've done this in federal, provincial, and municipal elections. And we've been able to quantify that it's a condition of work on the digital campaign trail to get identity attacks, threats, and sexually explicit content your way. You're going to get the most of it if you have a very high profile and or if you're underrepresented in our democracy, if you're from a community like that. So this is going to affect who runs. It's also going to affect who stays. We have exit interviews with former members of parliament that speak to this in detail. But then there's also this broader chilling effect on civic engagement because all of that content is readily available to everybody online. It's publicly accessible, and it sends a signal that you should stay away from these conversations when there's really such tremendous opportunity for these tools to be drawing people in. And so, with this type of legislation is an opportunity to kind of shift these working conditions, create a different culture, evolve how we use these tools, get some control back, some sense back. Mm. And I think the regulator has an important role to play here in working to represent the public interest, which really has been quite absent from our understanding so far.
You will not be surprised to hear, Barbara, that I spend too much time talking to politicians. And I'm not sure I've talked to any, regardless of political stripe, who say they don't feel threatened at some point in their day by people who are hateful online and who would want to do them serious harm. Mm-hmm. And I think we all have, I suspect we all remember that image of a guy who looked about 6'2 and 250 pounds going after 5-foot-tall Chrystia Freeland at an elevator in Alberta, where her, I mean, as it turned out, her life wasn't threatened, but she didn't know that at that moment. So this is a problem. How much do you think we can really legislate out of existence some of the difficulties we're talking about here?
Well, I think it's part of a broader strategy. You know, the government likes to talk about a whole government response. I like to talk about a whole society response, that it is the work, for example, that civil society organizations are doing in this space in terms of working and supporting victims, whether that's individuals or communities, in terms of providing strategies around critical digital literacy, all of those pieces, the work that even, you know, folks in the academy, like Dax, for instance, are doing in this space is so important. And I think if anything else, the importance of government support for that activity, providing infrastructure funding, providing supports and guidance and advice. I think that is so important to continuing the good work that's always going on, also already going on the ground in those organizations. So this legislation, I think, is part of that package and will help to inform some of those strategies that people will be engaging in down the road in terms of, how to apply the legislation. So training with law enforcement, for example, about how to think about the legislation, because that's been obviously one of the shortcomings is the failure to enforce the legislation we already have. So enhanced education that can come from civil society or, the academy in that space. So there are so many pieces to this puzzle that we add on to the legislation.
Give the Fed some advice, Dax, in our last minute here.
I'd be happy to, and it'll be really interesting to see how this pitch legislation actually shakes out in the committee stage. I worry that there will be a backlash specifically in response to the amendments to the Criminal Code and the Canadian Human Rights Act, and I think that'll be the fulcrum of the debate as it plays out. I think, as I mentioned before, the stuff related to making digital platforms accountable and transparent and using almost duty of care concept to protect users is merited, and that can find some consensus. What I really would like to see is perhaps a more artful way to make those amendments. What happened previously with the demise of Section 13 is that nobody really cared about prosecuting white supremacists or expression that found itself on the margins of public discourse. Sometimes that trickles in, obviously. But if complaints are made and there are respondents in those complaints where the expression at issue is further towards the mainstream, people will see that as an illegitimate restriction of their expression and free expression. And my worry is that what will happen is that that specific debate and controversy and backlash will prejudice and perhaps even jeopardize the enterprise as a whole. So I would separate these two things, personally.
Last quick word to you on this as well. Give the Fed some advice.
Civil society organizations and citizens assemblies have played such a key role in shaping this response. They should continue to play a role in having their insights applied because this response needs to evolve and be refined over time. So taking an iterative posture here, I think, is key.
Gotcha. I want to thank Sabrina Dellen from the Samaro Center for Democracy, Dax D'Arazio from Queen's University, Barbara Perry from Ontario Tech University for joining us here for, if I may say, a very civilized discussion about a very controversial topic. So thank you all for that.
Thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks.
The Agenda with Steve Paikin is made possible through generous philanthropic contributions from viewers like you. Thank you for supporting TVO's journalism.